As some of you know, I spent last year teaching Introduction to Feminism at Boston College. Today's reading comes from something I used to assign to my students. They were college students. They could manage it. I have faith that you can too. It is dense. So I just ask you to listen carefully, and in the sermon, I'll be talking about why I chose this text. And thank you to Rita for reading.
The overarching matrix of domination houses multiple groups, each with varying experiences of penalty and privilege that produce corresponding partial perspectives, situated knowledges, and for clearly identifiable subordinate groups, subjugated knowledges. No one group has a clear angle of vision. No one group possesses the theory of methodology that allows it to discover the truth, or worse yet, proclaim its theories and methodologies as the universal norm, evaluating other groups' experiences. Each group speaks from its own standpoint and shares its own partial situated knowledge.
I think I forgot to say that the reading comes from Patricia Hill Collins, a Black feminist writer, and the book is on Black feminist epistemology, or the study of knowledge. I posted on Facebook a couple days ago as I was working on this that deciding to preach on feminist epistemology may not have been the brightest idea for my sermon idea so far, but we'll see. But I chose it because this passage expresses one of the most important spiritual insights that I have gleaned from feminist theory. Each group speaks from its own standpoint and shares its own partial, situated knowledge. In other words, whatever we experience and think to be absolutely, obviously true is only part of the picture. I believe that this insight, this honest recognition of the limits of our understanding, can change how we approach the practice of discussion. So let's break down the reading to try and hear what Patricia Hill Collins is saying. At the core, I understand her to be talking about the impacts of social inequality on our very knowledge of ourselves in our world. We do not live in an equal world. We don't. People are treated differently because of the color of their skin, or whether they are a she or a he, or whether or not they love someone who is the same sex. Of course, we imagine and long for a world in which race, class, gender, sexuality, physical ability, nationality, and so many other isms do not matter. But they do still matter. There are both lasting legacies as well as the ongoing practices of inequality in our society and in each of us. We live within what Hill Collins calls a matrix of domination, by which she simply means that we live in an intersecting matrix of social dynamics that tells us some groups are more important, more powerful than others. We all know these social rankings, even if we disagree with them or fight to change them. I suspect that we're all pretty used to thinking about how social inequality shapes opportunities. I like how Hill Collins suggests that there are multiple groups and that each group has different experiences of both penalty and privilege. Certainly, it's easy to see how some groups on the subjugated or less powerful side of inequality can be harmed. The poor go hungry and suffer from inadequate health care. Women can be physically struck for speaking up. Blacks face disproportionate jail time in an era of mass incarceration. But all groups have both penalty and privilege. Yesterday morning, I was at a workshop on class with several of you. We heard a woman who passionately spoke up with the gifts that she had taken from growing up working class. She claimed with pride the value of hard work and the dignity that gave to her. As a member of a group defined as working class, she refused to be defined only by the penalty of lower wages and claimed also the privilege of what she gained from her experience. Listening to her, I thought about the cost, the penalty of moving from a more moderate middle class upbringing to a place of more financial security and social status as a holder of graduate degrees from Ivy League schools. While I certainly have economic and social privileges that I never imagined I would have as a kid, I have also paid a cost by moving away geographically and culturally from my family and childhood friends and my beloved natural landmarks. I have missed so many birthday parties and family gatherings, and I still prefer the fresh water of Lake Michigan over the saltiness of the ocean. To gain entry into the ranks of the highly educated, I paid a penalty with weakened connections to the people and places that I hold dear. Each group has its penalty and its privilege in the matrix of domination. The many differences in the cost that we've paid and the privileges that we've been given mean that different groups have different experiences. We see things differently depending on which group or groups that we belong to. Hill Collins describes these differences as a kind of situated knowledge, knowledge that comes from particular contexts and experiences. She insists that what we know emerges from where we stand within this matrix, within this intersecting web of social dynamics. Where we stand within society shapes our experiences and how we see ourselves and our larger world. And most importantly, she insists that no one ever stands outside this social system. When we are learning and gaining knowledge about ourselves and the world, we are always within this matrix, within this social system. The idea that knowledge is always shaped by where we stand within our society has profoundly shaped my sense of self in the world. The idea that knowledge is situated within social context means that my perspective is always partial. I'm only ever seeing the world from where I stand. Of course, the idea of a partial knowledge seems dangerous and wrong to some. I grew up evangelical Christian, and in that tradition, there was the truth, one truth, God's truth, and we knew what that truth was. Sometimes the sense of an absolute, universal truth brought comfort. I knew what would happen to me after I died. I knew what had happened to those who I love who had died. I knew that there was a plan for my life, that I only had to discern and listen and trust. But with this absolute truth, there also was ever-increasing anxiety. It seemed that the more I experienced and understood of the broader world, the harder it became to be so certain. Admittedly, there are some aspects of math and science that function quite well with an absolute sense of truth. But moral and spiritual truths about human nature and the purpose of life, I think, are much harder to be certain about. Sometimes our certainty about the world is upended by a tragedy that shakes up how we see everything, like a bomb exploding at a finish line, or a gunman opening fire at an elementary school. Sometimes our certainty about the world is challenged by encountering a person or a group of people whose lives is so different than our own, like what some of you who have traveled to Katrina have seen and experienced. It is a big, big world with so many different kinds of people in many different places whose experiences vary tremendously. I think the message about water made us think about that, about how people's experiences in other parts of the world are so different than our own. Our experiences are but a fraction, the tiniest thread of the fabric of the universe. So does this diversity of experience just mean that everything is relative? Are all differences just variations within groups where all are equally valid? If there's no absolute truth, no objective place to stand outside the system, then is everything just relative? I think that's the fear people have. But I don't think that our only options are either to believe in absolute certain truth or to think that there is nothing but total relativity. Indeed, this is the spiritual insight I have gleaned from Patricia Hill Collins and her Black feminist theory, that there is a third way between absolute truth and moral relativity. The third way is to see that all knowledge is situated and partial. Yes, we do all have knowledge about the world in which we live, but it is only ever partial. We need to recognize the limits of our knowledge. And we need to listen to what the world looks like from where another person or group stands. For example, I can see the limits of my own knowledge when I consider how growing up in a safe, middle-class suburb means that I don't know what it's like to live in a neighborhood riddled by violence where simply getting to school and back risks my safety. And as a heterosexual, I don't know what it's like to fall in love and to be afraid to walk down the street holding hands with that person. And as a white woman, I don't know what it's like to walk into a store and have a clerk watch my every move lest I steal something, or to walk into a gated community and be approached as an intruder. At a recent race workshop that several of you participated in, the question was raised, what do we not know? What do we not know about race? What do we not know about the privilege and penalties of belonging to a particular racial or class or other social group? There are limits to our knowledge, to our partial perspective. I challenge you to wrestle with this question. What do you not know? There are many ways to approach this question. One place is to better understand where you stand. How does your personal standpoint, your story, intersect with the larger dynamics and legacies of our society. I'll give you an example. Growing up, I was proudly told that one of my ancestors, was the first white child to be born in Paulding County, Ohio. In recent years, I learned that he was the first white child because at the time of his birth, there was no Paulding County, Ohio. There was only territory owned and controlled by Native Americans. In other words, my ancestors were part of the legacy of the Western frontier that colonized Indian territories. Learning this changes not only how I think about my connection to my past and my ancestors, but also how I support, vote, and think about Native Americans today who continue to struggle for recognition and resources within the U.S. Knowing where you stand can begin by relearning your own history, what you don't know about your life, or the life of your extended family, and how it's been shaped by larger social expectations, policies, and resources. In the feminist movement, this kind of effort of tying your personal story with larger social issues is known as simply making the personal political. I think it is important to know how our individual lives tie into this larger social story. We are a part of the matrix of domination, or, as we might say in Unitarian Universalist principles, the interconnected web of all existence. So one way to explore what you do not know is by learning about one's own personal story. Another way to explore what you do not know is to listen and learn from someone who stands somewhere different than you. For the readers among us, and I suspect there are a few, this might mean picking up a book written by someone from a different social group or different social or political perspective. In my own life, I made a commitment at the race workshop that I would pay closer attention to bringing voices from people of color into my sermons and into my readings. But reading is not the only way to listen or learn, of course. There are also other forms of media and some great films and documentaries out there. And there are opportunities, small and large, to listen and learn in experiential ways. There are trips to New Orleans, or the recent overnight at City Reach in Boston that many of our youth and some of our adults experienced. There are service learning trips for youth and adults with the Unitarian Universalist College of Social Justice. And there is signing up to be a part of the Family Promise team and sitting down and having dinner with some of our guests. And of course, there is simply walking downstairs to coffee hour in a few minutes. If we start with the assumption that our knowledge is limited and our perspective is partial, I think we can begin to open ourselves anew to what we do not know. What can we learn from each other? What do you not know about each other, especially those that you don't usually talk to? What would it be like to start a conversation with someone from a different group, someone who is not in your covenant group, or close in age, or in the same committee? What might you learn when you engage in discussion with someone from a different standpoint? I believe that it is a deep spiritual practice to live with a sense of one's own partial, situated knowledge. It means that we all have a lot to learn about where we stand and a lot to learn from those whose standpoints are different than our own. Living with this sense of a partial, situated knowledge does mean losing some of the comfort of that absolute certain truth. Yet it is also an invitation to explore what you do not know, to enter into a discussion with others from whom you can learn and who can learn from you. So may it be. Amen.